Well, we certainly have a lot to talk about today on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll, of course, talk about the aftermath of the firing of the FBI director, James Comey, by President Trump. We'll talk a little bit about whether or not we're going to see some debates in the 6th District Congressional race. Karen Handel and John Ossoff, we assume we are, but there are some interesting dynamics at play. We'll discuss those. And on Monday's show, we promised that since Sally Yates had not begun her testimony up on the Hill in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, that today we'd look at a couple of things that she had to say and talk about how her presentation on the Hill may, in fact, fuel an interest among Georgia Democrats in seeing her run for office here, possibly for governor. Today we have with us Kyle Wingfield. He is a columnist, of course, for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thursdays and Sundays, you're in the hard print in the Dead Tree edition of the
paper. That's right. That's right.
So you've Colin Murg, give us a preview. What are we going to read from you tomorrow?
Guess what it's about. James Comey.
James Comey. Good. All right. Well, we'll talk a little about what you're going to say in that, or you've said in writing that column. Jackie Cushman, we haven't seen you in a while. It's very nice to have you back as well. Jackie is a Republican blogger and is all over the map. Every time I turn around, you are on some cable network talking about politics. So we're grateful you're here, Jackie.
Glad to be here.
Michael Smith, communications director for the Georgia Democratic Party, is back. Thank you for being here today, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
And Patricia Murphy. We haven't seen you in a while either. Patricia Murphy is a columnist for The Daily Beast. Spent a lot of time working up on Capitol Hill for Max Cleland when he was a member of the United States mm-hmm. Senate.
And Sam Nunn.
And Sam, that's right.
Yes. Of course. Richard Bryan from Nevada. The list goes on.
Let me give you a quick update on what's going on with Comey. The New York Times broke a really fascinating story about an hour and a half ago. Days before he was fired, the Times reported, Comey asked the Justice Department for a significant increase in money and personnel for the Bureau's investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election. They're sourcing three congressional officials on that one. And Comey made that request of Rod Rothstein, who is the Deputy Attorney General, who is the one who wrote the memo laying out the reasons why the president should, in fact, fire Comey. We'll talk a little bit about that. The president made brief comments about Comey. When reporters came into a photo op he was involved with, he said quite simply, quote, Comey wasn't doing a good job. He went on to accuse Democrats of hypocrisy for criticizing the dismissal of Comey, since Democrats had been very critical of Comey in the aftermath of the Clinton email investigation. So there's other things that we can talk about, but I think we should just move on and begin this conversation. So Kyle, you said you will see your column on this tomorrow. Let's start with you. Just in the broadest strokes, what do you make of something that some people on one extreme are calling a constitutional crisis, and others on the other side of this are saying, absolutely, this has had to happen. Comey was really overstepping his bounds.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a constitutional crisis. I mean, the FBI director does work for the president. And second, the Congress is more than capable and empowered, one, to ensure that we get a solid, well-credentialed, and independent person to replace James Comey in that job, who can be trusted to pursue the existing and any future investigations as they need to be pursued, and to oversee the agency in the meantime. I mean, that is one thing that Congress has probably not done well enough over the years, is exercising that oversight authority that it has. I know it's one reason Georgia's Senator Johnny Isaacson talks about doing a 2-year budget cycle so that Congress can spend the off year providing more oversight to government agencies. So I think Congress can help navigate this in the meantime. There are enough skeptical Republican senators that it's going to be no sure thing for Trump to get a majority for whoever he nominates. So no constitutional crisis. And then to answer the second part of the question, I do think if everybody takes a step back and takes a deep breath, there was pretty widespread belief that the credibility of James Comey in leading the FBI in a credible way was shot. And so there's questions about the timing, and those are fair. There are questions about what else is going on. But I don't think anyone can seriously argue that he was going to be able to continue very long in that job and be seen as a credible figure.
Before we go any further, I want to point out that we've been calling this morning, our producer Lisa Clark has been calling Georgia congressional offices to see if we can get anybody to talk about this. And so far, you know, we haven't seen a lot of people out there wanting to go on the record. We'll see what happens in the next day or so, but we have been making that effort.
David Perdue issued a very,
very
short statement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basic support for the move. Yeah.
Okay, so you raised the question. I throw this out, and somebody grab it. The timing. In the memo that the Assistant Attorney General wrote, he said that this was based, the firing needed to happen because of the way in which Comey handled the investigation of and the aftermath of the Hillary Clinton email scandal. Well, that happened last summer. So the timing, even you point this out, Kyle, seems a little suspect, yes?
I think it's very suspect. I don't know if it's because the Hillary Clinton investigation was last year, because Comey has continued to discuss the emails in open testimony in a way that made even Democrats very uncomfortable, naming Huma Abedin, who they decided not to bring charges against, and going into great detail that ended up being inaccurate about how those emails were transferred to her husband's computer. Even Democrats were very uncomfortable with the way that that happened. But I think much more important in terms of timing and process is the fact that Comey didn't know about this until he saw it on CNN. Sean Spicer was literally hiding in the bushes at the White House last night instead of discussing this with reporters who wanted to talk to him about it on the record. It's obvious that the press shop had no idea that this was happening. And so I think this is a decision that President Trump could defend in a responsible way by being upfront and transparent and open with the public. But because he hasn't done that, and it was also done at the end of the day, they'd already had the press briefing, it just created so much chaos around this because there would be very difficult questions and important questions to answer about how this relates to the Russia probe. And then he meets today with the Russian foreign minister. The only pictures we get are from the Russian embassy. Just totally bizarre and just the wrong way to handle this. Comey had problems, but I think Donald Trump has compounded his own problems by the way they've rolled this out.
Jackie, let's listen to a very short soundbite from Senator John McCain, one of the Republicans who spoke out with some expression of concern about how this was handled.
When you fire probably, arguably, the most respected person in America, you'd better have a very good explanation. And so far, I haven't seen that.
You know, Jackie, the most respected person in America. I don't think James Comey has been called that, unfortunately, by Republicans or Democrats for a very long time.
He has been. So you have to look back at this past summer and when he went in front of the public several different times, depending on when it was, wants to say that, you know, they were dismissing it, and then wants to say that, yeah, there was still something there. But the real, and it's really worth the read. And I know that most people around here have read it, but if you haven't read it and you're listening at home or in the car, go and read the memo from Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, that he sent to Jeff Sessions. It's 2.5 pages, but it's very clear that there's a lot of concern, and their concern is, can he lead the FBI? And from both sides of the aisle in the last 9 months, you've had either Republicans or Democrats, depending on the time, saying that we should get rid of him. So clearly, he has become political, okay? Whether you agree this is the right time, I mean, clearly he is a political figure now because he has put himself out, and this letter articulates it very well. He's no longer investigating. He's now talking about the investigating with the public. And in some cases, he's actually presenting his opinion about whether or not it should be prosecuted, which really is not his job. I mean, his job is to investigate and to hand it over to the Justice Department, who then does their job. So he's clearly out of bounds in terms of what has happened. Regarding to the timing, I think this is a challenge. This memo is dated yesterday, okay? And then it went to Sessions. Sessions get this memo, and this memo does not say he should be fired, but it says very clearly That, you know, having to refuse his errors, the director cannot be expected to implement the necessary corrective action. So he can't lead the FBI. This leads Jeff Sessions to say, we should actually, you know, we need a new leader. He sends this to Trump. So the question I have regarding the timing, because I hear what you're saying, and clearly it could have been done more cleanly. Obviously it could have been. But given the fact that, this is a very clear memo, he's a very politicized figure, this goes to Sessions. Sessions suggested to Trump he should get rid of him. What is Trump to do regarding timing? Wait a day, wait 2 days? Possibly, but Trump, again, I wrote a column about this last week, Trump is not used to politics. Okay, we gotta remember that. And Trump is not used to thinking about the process of politics. He's an entrepreneur, so he does what he normally does. He acts.
Well, but this has been under consideration for at least a week, according to multiple sources, that they've been thinking about this and mulling it for many, many days in the White House.
Well, I think he's been a political figure for months. So the question is, when do you do that? You don't want to do it at the beginning of the administration. You have no attorney general, and you have no you have nobody else to take over. So you have to kind of make progress.
Michael, let me get you into the mix here. So it is certainly true, and President Trump has pointed this out in at least one tweet, that people like Chuck Schumer, Democrats like Chuck Schumer, a long time ago said they'd lost confidence in the FBI director. Trump accuses them of hypocrisy at this point because now that he's been fired, they're reacting with shock and concern. But here's what I'd love to have you address, if you could. So here's an interesting scenario. Rothstein was confirmed as deputy AG, I think, 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
So the scenario that we are asked to accept here is that he comes, he moves in, he's there for 2 weeks, and in his first 2 weeks on the job, he thinks, you know, I really ought to look into whether Comey should continue as FBI director. I ought to give that a lot of thought and sit down and write a memo making a recommendation. That doesn't mean Comey doesn't deserve to be fired, but it seems to me, Michael, it raises questions about where did this start, at the Department of Justice or at the White House?
It should raise a lot of questions. It should raise a lot of eyebrows, too. The timing is everything. This happened the same day that subpoenas were issued from a grand jury to investigate ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. And as Patricia brought up earlier, timing's everything. When today we have Rex Tillerson escorting a Russian foreign minister,
Sergei Lavrov,
straight into the Oval Office. So what is the public supposed to think about all of this? Let's give everyone the benefit of the doubt and say that there's nothing to see here. This is just poor optics at the very least, but very troubling.
You know, Kai, one of the things that strikes me that is, if I were a Republican on the Hill, one of the things that I wonder about is you have some heavy lifting to do in the months ahead. You want the Senate's got to consider and try to come up with a health care bill that the House is then going to have to work on with them to get that through. Trump's got a very aggressive tax reform plan that he wants to put into place. It strikes me that when you act in the way that the president did on this, you're distracting from the kind of issues that the Congress is going to have to work. How many weeks will it be before they settle right down up there and can actually work on, say, health care?
Well, I think if you're going to, we talked earlier about whether it's a constitutional crisis, I think the crisis here, if there is one, has to do with competence, right? I mean, it's, can this White House take a look at the big picture, like you're talking about, decide what needs to be prioritized, what can be done now, game out what the reaction's going to be, you know, not just game it out, but according to the reports I saw, they didn't even start contacting senators and members of Congress until 5 o'clock yesterday when it was basically out.
Schumer got a call. Lindsey Graham got a call.
And then they were surprised, according to those accounts, that there was negative reaction. So, you know, in terms of getting back to the timing, On the one hand, doing it after the Russian foreign minister visited might have looked even worse in some ways. But, you know, there was, if this was the first day it could have been done with the recommendation from the deputy AG, there was no reason it had to be done on the first day. There's no reason it had to be done within the first week. You could have waited a couple of weeks, had that all rolled out. I mean, the last time an FBI director was fired was Bill Clinton firing William Sessions in 1993. Right. They had the replacement ready to roll out the next day. That, you know, we've seen this administration do that with like the Gorsuch nomination that was very well rolled out. But that's been more the exception than the rule with him. And this, unfortunately, was a chance for them to prove that they can handle this, and they didn't pass the test this time.
Let me point out before, I know you want to get a word in here, Jackie, that the White House, the daily press briefing started, I guess, about 20 minutes ago, a little bit before we went on the air. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is leading it, we're told, because Sean Spicer had pre-scheduled reserve duty. He is in the reserve. But you're skeptical, Michael. I saw the look on your face. You don't think Spicer is gone for reserve duty? You think they pushed him aside to do this briefing?
Absolutely not.
Jackie, but one of the things that Sanders said is this. Sanders says that Comey committed, and this is a direct quote, atrocities in circumventing the chain of command. Atrocities.
Well, she needs to pass that on to her boss, who congratulated Comey for all of his wonderful work on the Hillary Clinton email scandal until he let her off, quote, let her off the hook. I just think, I mean, it's more than just an optical problem. We have Rosenstein is now also both the head of the Russia probe. The FBI has no leader at this point. The Russians are actively engaged in cyber attacks against the United States. There's a White House that doesn't seem to know up from down. Donald Trump has been practically in the witness protection program, except for his willingness to tweet about this all morning. And so I think you have a crisis of competence and a crisis of confidence. I don't think we're at a constitutional crisis at all, but it is just a very disturbing tableau for Capitol Hill to be watching. And even Comey actually did have the respect and support from a number of senators on the Hill. Maybe not the, you know, the people on the left and right, but he was not the first person that anybody would have gotten rid of if you took a vote in the Senate.
Yeah, I'm not sure we have a confidence crisis, but I think that's fascinating you mentioned that, because I think there's a lot of confidence in the White House. I do think...
in America.
Well, but I do think Rosenstein, I mean, just let's back up and let's look at who he is. He's a 26-year veteran in the Justice Department. He was, appointed by under Bush. He served under Obama for 8 years. I believe he was the only one that survived the Obama administration that was appointed. So he's obviously well respected on both sides. Eric Holder had him oversee the investigation into General James Cartwright, and he led that investigation. I think he's very well respected. So I think we'd be very careful about talking about him.
No,
he's
I'm not
serious,
talking about.
He's
I'm
a serious guy.
Confidence
he's,
in the president,
right,
not in Rosenstein.
Right,
said,
no,
who I agree.
But let me finish, please.
Fine.
But he's very confident. He's very serious, and I think he did go in there and say, "What are we going to do to lead the FBI? The FBI has to be led in such a way that people believe in it." And if you look at the last 9 months, both parties have definitely said at different times.
Do you think this started at Justice or at the White House?
I don't know. I'm not privy to that information. I mean, if you look at the memo that Rosenstein wrote, what he says is factually correct. Given that it's factually correct, I think you have to say, can he lead the FBI? I think a more important, more interesting question, which Kyle brought up, is who are they going to actually nominate to take his place?
Well,
I think that's a much more interesting process.
Right, we're hearing some names already popping up.
That, to me, is more interesting.
None of which have been confirmed by the White House, but we're hearing names like Ray Kelly, a former New York City police commissioner. Trey Gowdy, Politico says Trey Gowdy may be under consideration. Boy, talk about a polarizing choice.
Exactly, and I think depending on who they nominate, it makes a big difference.
All right, we're going to have to take a break. Michael, I want to get you in here as soon as we come back from the break, because you need to talk from the point of view of a Democratic Party official about what you see is happening. It's Political Rewind. We're going to take a short break and be right back in a moment.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're joined today by Patricia Murphy, Michael Smith of the Georgia Democratic Party, Jackie Gingrich-Cushman, and Kyle Wingfield. The White House press briefing is over. I'm looking through the notes that Lisa just handed me. I don't see that anything new came out of this briefing at this point, except to say that they reiterate the fact that a lot of members of Congress had lost faith in Comey. And that's true, Kyle,
right.
Republican and Democrat. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think, again, if we all take a step back, take a deep breath, decision go forward with Comey, not go forward with Comey, I don't think is necessarily controversial. What happens next, to continue what we were talking about before, could be controversial and is absolutely crucial. And that's where Congress needs to make sure that it's holding the executive branch accountable, and the president specifically.
Michael, when we learn, as we did today from the New York Times reporting, that this firing, the question of timing has been a significant question that's been asked. When we hear that just a few days ago, Comey went and asked for more funds and to expand the investigation, it's hard not to draw a line between that and the sudden decision to fire Comey. That may not be true, but unfortunately, perception matters in the business of politics and government.
Well, let's talk about a pattern. Sally Yates, she gets close to asking very serious questions to the White House about Michael Flynn. Then she is gone.
You think it's under the guise? When an acting attorney general refuses, says that her attorneys are not going to have to defend a president's executive order.
She happened to also be investigating ties to Russia.
Okay, I just want to make sure we are careful.
Yeah, absolutely.
This. She knew that would happen.
Bahar, he was assistant attorney up in New York. Who was also investigating had part to do with an investigation that involved Donald Trump. He was asked to resign. He refused, and then he was fired. And now Comey, if this is true, that he asked for funding just a few days ago, he gets dangerously close to the facts. He is gone. It's a pattern.
And to the if it's true part, I mean, the Justice Department is denying the report. They're calling it, quote, totally false. So we do need to wait.
Denying
and see
which report?
The report that he had asked for more money for that investigation.
Oh, okay.
Justice Department spokesman or woman.
Yeah, be very careful about drawing lines between things that might not exist.
Yeah, they are denying. Now, they could be denying and it could still be true, but right. I just wanted to put that out.
Well,
another thing I do think from a firing standpoint, I mean, timing, we can argue about timing, whether it's perfect or not. Clearly, it was not rolled out the right way. But, sometimes it's better if you're going to have to fire someone to just get it over with. I mean, you don't hold on to anything by waiting and waiting and waiting. You got to move on. Now, I think Trump has gotten where he's very happy creating chaos wherever he goes, and we'll see how long that lasts and if he transitions into a president that can actually govern. He is literally the only president we've ever had that has never had political or military experience. Literally.
Well,
and so he's in a very different world.
And it shows.
Yeah, I mean, that was considered a virtue by many voters.
This is what you get.
But this is what you get.
But he's also not making it easy for his staff to support him and to lead on an agenda. And I think it's starting to make it so difficult for people on Capitol Hill to get behind his agenda, because on any given day, it's difficult to know what that is.
So, Patricia, here's what's interesting. Kyle saying that if the White House is denying the New York Times reports about Comey asking for more money. And here's what I think is dangerous for the Trump administration right now. If we believe a lot of the reporting that's coming out of the FBI right now, Comey was a controversial figure, apparently, among his own men and women.
Yes.
Nevertheless, he had some very loyal FBI agents who really cared about his leadership. I think the potential danger, the Trump folks are so worried about leaks. If there are a series of leaks from Comey loyalists that are damaging to Trump, and we don't know for certain whether that's a revenge tactic or there's real material, I just think there's all sorts of Am I making up a scenario that seems far-fetched?
I don't. Well, obviously, we saw a whole bunch of leaking earlier in this administration.
Right.
There has been quite a bit of purging, which happens after every administration. So I think we'll have to wait and see what happens. I would like to give those agents the benefit of the doubt that they will be acting appropriately.
But that doesn't mean they might not want to leak information. What if these leaks came out of the FBI potentially, or career justice people? It suggests an effort to make the president perhaps look bad.
Remember what happened with the CIA earlier in the administration. I mean, this is not the first powerful bureaucracy Trump has taken on, and that one In fact, I'm trying to remember exactly how that ended. They sort of fought to a stalemate, and it got quiet again.
Right.
And you know, you do have to wonder. You would have liked to have seen Donald Trump, not a politician, as Jackie says, learn from that episode and not pick another fight with another powerful bureaucracy. Because in our system, it is designed so that when things are going well, it's still difficult to get things done. When things are not going well, it's extraordinarily difficult to get things done. Back to what you were saying earlier about health reform, tax reform,
immigration reform,
anything.
All right, we're going to move on in a moment, but I want to take on one other aspect of this that I think is interesting. And Jackie, I want to turn to you. We try not to associate you too often with your dad, but I cannot imagine Newt Gingrich creating a situation, a firing like this, without having all of his ducks in a row in terms of messaging, in terms of possible candidates to take Comey's place. We're told that for about 3 hours last night, no one in the White House was prepared to go on TV, to go to the newspaper reporter.
Didn't even know it was coming.
They didn't even know it was coming. That's crazy, Jackie.
I'm sure that, I have no doubt that's true. But the difference is, again, my father has been involved in politics since before I was born. He ran campaigns in Georgia as a congressional staffer. He worked when he was in graduate school. He then ran twice here and lost. He finally won in 78. He has done this for a very long time, and he's had a lot of experiences where he didn't handle things well. And we can spend a lot of time talking about those if we wanted to. But you know what? He learned from his mistakes. And my theory, and we'll see because we don't know until it happens, my theory is that hopefully Trump will learn from his mistakes and begin to understand that part of this process is not just actually making decisions, which he's used to, but thinking about how that fallout occurs and how his stuff can happen.
As we get set to move on, Michael, can the country afford to have a president of the United States who is learning on the job the way that Donald Trump is? That strikes me as the logical question to ask coming out of Jackie's comments.
That is what we've been saying for, 18 months now? The easiest way to take all the controversy out of all of this is to set up a 9/11 style commission to investigate this with a special prosecutor. There's agreement on both sides of the aisle for that.
Yeah.
And I don't see what the resistance from certain individuals.
What do you mean, certain individuals?
The president and even candidates who just can't say, yes, there should be an independent
counsel. Are we going to get an independent counsel? Is in fact that almost no?
Well, there is no such thing as an independent counsel anymore because that statute has expired in 1999.
Special prosecutor.
You could, but that person still reports back to the Justice Department. Yeah. So could it be really independent? I just don't think we will. And I don't think that members of Congress are going to give away their authority. I do want to say one quick thing. I don't think this is just an optics problem. It is an optics problem, but we're not talking about the Easter egg roll. I mean, this is the man who is leading the investigation as to whether or not your campaign colluded with a foreign enemy. So it's much more serious than, oops, I forgot to send out a press release. I think we've got, the question is, was this a mistake or a cover-up? And so that's what this is all going to be getting toward down the road.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get our second break of the show out of the way, because when we come back, and we'll make a transition, and Michael, you're going to get the first shot at this. What is the impact of the Trump firing of Comey, potentially, on the 6th District Congressional race, if any? We'll take that on when we come back. By the way, we're starting to get lots of tweets. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We'll get to some of those tweets after the break, and then talk about how this might have an impact or not on the 6th District race.
Dear Dick, this is about obsession.
Jill Soloway, the creator of the Amazon series Transparent, now has a new Amazon series titled I Love Dick, about a feminist filmmaker attracted to a macho artist. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Soloway about the new series and about gender and identity and why she now considers herself non-binary. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back. Michael Smith, since everything about the 6th District Congressional race between Karen Handel and John Ossoff seems to have been nationalized, and let's talk about whether that's really correct or not and how that will have an impact on the road. Ossoff immediately said we need an independent counsel. That was his statement. Karen Handel essentially said, I'm paraphrasing, I think Trump had to get rid of him. He did the right thing. Is this an issue that you think will have an impact on the race up there?
At the end of the day, I think that the voters are eventually going to decide on kitchen table issues, not necessarily this. However, this does illustrate the differences between the two candidates. The Ossoff campaign came right out of the gate with a very strong statement. There was no question on where he stood. And we waited almost a day to hear from Karen Handel on her thoughts on this. And it seems kind of like a running theme that every time there's a tough question, you have to put an APB out for her to get it. And we just sit and wait.
Okay, Kyle, what are the kitchen table issues? It seems to me this entire race is nationalized.
Yeah, I disagree with that. With Michael there, I do think that this is largely a nationalized race, and people thinking, even in the district, are thinking about it as, which side am I on?
Trump side or the anti-Trump
side? The Trump side or the not Trump side,
right.
And, you know, I have spoken with some pretty high-level Republicans in Georgia who recognize that, who recognize the problem that that creates for them. If you look at the 40% a Democrat usually gets in that district versus the 47-48% that Hillary Clinton and then John Ossoff in the first round of balloting got, that seems to be the difference, is especially educated women in those suburban areas turned off by Donald Trump.
Patricia, there does seem to be one local issue that perhaps can have an impact in the outcome. John Ossoff does not live in the district. He grew up there, but all of the national reporting on this has pointed it out. And Bob Costa in the Washington Post did a piece not long ago in which he said just that. How many people he heard from down here who were concerned about that very thing? That's the one local issue that could have some impact. Yes.
Well, I would assume it would matter to anybody who's voting whether or not this person. You can dismiss it. I've talked to a lot of Ossoff people who just didn't care. He did grow up in the district. His parents live in the district. He lives 3 blocks from the district. You know, they have their talking points ready to go. And some of them literally don't care. To them, it's not about where John Ossoff lives. It's about Donald Trump and the White House, the Ossoff supporters. And so it is a highly nationalized race. Actually, there was one local issue I was very surprised was resonating with voters, particularly the suburban women that Kyle is talking about, was the campus carry bill.
Oh, that's
really
right.
Really surprised.
That's right.
It's a very important issue, I think, to the Cobb moms, to a lot of moms who are very worried about this concept. And they were associating Karen Handel, who had nothing to do with that decision, associating her with other Republicans in the state. It's just kind of Republicans writ large. Is it not to say that those people don't like Nathan Deal? They just didn't. They don't like that bill. They don't like guns on campus. They don't like Donald Trump. It's sort of this big collection of those kinds of issues.
So one of the ways that I think this Comey situation does impact the race is what we were talking about earlier about making it more difficult to get things done in Congress. One of the things that I have heard from Republicans saying is if we could get a victory or two up on the scoreboard before June 20th, that could help peel back some of those Republicans who didn't vote for our people or our candidates the first time, because, you know, getting some things done that they want to see done could outweigh whatever just more vague concerns they have about
That's
Trump.
That's interesting. But Jackie, Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications, who just had a poll for WSB-TV on this race not long ago, found only about under 5% of voters undecided. So people have taken sides. And we don't know that. I think I'm right to say that when you, well, we're still a month out, actually. Mm-hmm. So those people may actually go to the polls. So 4%, 5% with a race that apparently is this close, it strikes me, are people who may still be persuadable, and who knows what is going to persuade them to take
a
side.
I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I do want to point out, I mentioned this earlier, I do want to point out when you talk about the 6th District of Georgia, because I have been around so long, that district was actually, that district was in the 70s. That's actually west of Atlanta. It included Atlanta Airport down to Griffin and over to Paulding County, over to Alabama. It got moved in 1992. Bill, you'll probably remember this, when the Georgia state legislator tried to chop up my father's district into tiny little pieces so that he would not be able to run. Literally, that's what happened.
And that's exactly right.
Yes, and I've actually got Billy Lovett saved an article for me, and that gave it to me a couple weeks ago, so I can thank Billy for the article. But what happened in that process is the number six got moved up north. So yeah. this is the district my dad had in 92 and since, and it's been moved around a little bit since then, but it is not the actual same geographic district that was held in 78 by him. So just a little history.
So tell us what that means to you. It means to me is
when the New York Times or anybody else talks about how this has been a Republican district forever, it really hasn't been. It wasn't until the wave of 94, when the Republican, revolution, that this area really became Republican. So, it's a little different than is often talked about. But let's talk about the current race. I think a couple of things. First of all, it is a national race because there are millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars pouring in from both sides, both to candidates and to PACs, to make this, because it's a very important national race. I mean, you have people from the New York Times coming down and trailing people. I mean, it's crazy. But also what that means is people are thinking about it from a national perspective, but what's going to really happen in the end, it's all going to be determined by turnout. It depends on who actually shows up and goes to vote. And
absolutely.
And that depends on rain. That depends on, it depends on a lot of things. And we literally will not know until people show up and vote. So to be perfectly frank, when the runoff happened and Ossoff got a higher percentage than the high 40s, I was actually happy, because that meant Republicans were going to pay attention and actually be concerned. And I think they should be concerned. And I think both sides should work very hard, because in the end, it all depends on who actually shows up.
And I totally agree with you. It's so about turnout. And mm-hmm. So how activated, how generated are the people who went the last time and maybe even didn't go the last time but want to have their voice this time around? I do think something like yesterday's events helps Democrats in that column, because it just reinforces to them, Donald Trump is president, Donald Trump is president. That's what this race is about on that side.
I think if you look at the letter that the Deputy Attorney General sent in to Trump, I think you would say that a lot of Republicans were saying, you know what, he needed to get fired, and I'm glad he did it. So I think it'll actually generate on both sides a lot of enthusiasm.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Michael, the Republicans, I frankly don't remember what organization bought the time for this ad. I do not think it's a Karen Handel ad, but forgive me, one of you may know. I think one of the funniest ads I've seen in any congressional race in the United States happens to be an ad that goes after John Ossoff. What they've done in the commercial, which you obviously can't see, we'll play just a little of it for you. It's a number of people, presumably who live in San Francisco, and we see them on streets in San Francisco, looking the way you sort of think people in San Francisco might look, hippie-like, whatever. Let's just listen to a little of it.
Hi, Georgia. San Francisco just wanted to say thank you.
We already have Nancy Pelosi as our congresswoman. Now you're going to give us John Ossoff as our congressman.
We're proud that California is the leading funder of the John Ossoff campaign.
Michael, what do you think? Pretty funny ad.
It was a terrible commercial. One. I was just in San Francisco back in January. Yeah. That is not what it looks like.
They're lovely people. Yeah.
Actually, yeah. I agree.
Beautiful.
It's
okay,
crazy.
But does it make a point?
No, I have a very hard time trying to follow their point.
Okay.
it did come from Paul Ryan's PAC, right? The
congressional
one associated
leadership
with
congressional
leadership.
I think it's the congressional leadership, and I think, but it is. I know it's a PAC.
I think it's that PAC.
I could be wrong
on the actual one.
That's
it, yeah.
If your average contribution is right around $200,000, which it is for that PAC, then they could afford a much better commercial than that, and it just rings hollow.
Well, there is an irony to the fact that PAC spending is most certainly all out-of-state money.
Yes, exactly. But
it is true that John Ossoff is John Ossoff today because of the huge wave of millions and millions of dollars that just flowed into this race because it's a special election. Mm-hmm. It was the only game in town this spring. And so Democratic activists, especially, I talked to the people at Daily Kos a lot about this race. They had their eye on this seat and then on John Ossoff very early. So they endorsed him way before the other Democrats even had a chance to get up and running. And so that is why John Ossoff is competitive in this race. He is, you know, I think he's a candidate that is performing well also, but he would, without the outside money from outside of the state, this race would not look the way it does today.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting to watch him because he's obviously grown as a candidate and he's very good in his feet. But I do think in the end that people will look at, and he grew up there, he's from there, he doesn't live there. And I think it will make a difference whether or not he actually lives in the district.
And hasn't lived there as an adult either. I mean, he went to college out of state, lived overseas for a while. I don't think he's lived in the sixth since he finished his,
I don't know. He did
high
work
school,
for Georgia members.
Yeah, and we have learned that there are something like 20 plus members of the U.S. House who don't live in their districts around the country.
In fact, he would be the third. He would be the third member of Congress living in the fifth district, actually, because David Scott is one of them.
But I got to say that from my perspective, maybe it's different because of my background. But you know, I wouldn't want to run for a district that I didn't live in. I mean, that's just my perspective. If you could actually represent these people and they're going to supposedly be your neighbors and who you talk about, I think that's part of the term about Paul Ryan is he actually flies back home and he's in Wisconsin. He understands the people that he lives with. And I think it's really important to have that connection.
Okay. We're going to watch that race. By the way, Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications will be here on Friday along with Jim Galloway. We'll talk more about the race and what he saw in the crosstabs as he dug down into his research. Of course, he's a Republican pollster and yet and certainly favors Republican candidates, but his polling has often been considered really a gold standard. He gets things right an awful lot of the time, regardless of his partisan leanings, right, Kyle?
Yeah, he does a good job locally and particularly, I mean, you know, polling is, there's a lot of art to it, but his final poll right before Election Day, I'll put a good bit of stock in.
Yeah. Okay, let me get to a few tweets, and then I want to talk Sally Yates for a few minutes. Matt Schweitzer says, The panel said that Trump fired the FBI director immediately, like a corporate move, essentially. But he didn't seem to have that issue with when firing Flynn, Michael Flynn. And that's true. It took 18 days after Sally Yates went to him to tell him about some problems there. Ben Andrews says, while a majority of public didn't have confidence in Comey, it's reported the majority of his staff still did trust him, similar to how Trump is viewed by the public versus his staff. Neil Cassidy, should Congress call Comey to ask more questions? Did Comey actually tell Trump three times you're not being investigated? And that's really interesting because Trump in his letter, so while I deeply appreciate you're telling me personally three times I'm not under investigation, but the White House will not tell us what those three instances were.
And even though the deputy AG's letter refers to the Hillary Clinton investigation, that was the only investigation the president mentioned in his letter was
the one
not into him.
In fact, I think there's already been a request from at least one Senate committee this afternoon that Comey come and testify. Mm-hmm. Barbara S. says, if Trump was so incensed about Comey and the Hillary Rodham Clinton email investigation, why didn't he fire him immediately after taking office? And that's going to be the question moving forward that I think Republicans and Democrats are somewhat concerned about.
Yeah, I think part of that is he had to wait. He didn't have an attorney general to begin with. So I think you've got to put a couple people in place so you're not left with no FBI director, no attorney general, nobody anywhere.
Do you mind? Look, we've known each other a long time. Mm-hmm. So can I put you on the spot?
Yeah.
You have really been in very articulately defending how Trump and the White House handled this. Do you find any concerns with the way all of this came down?
Well, let me be very clear. I defended that he did the right move. I said several times, and I agreed with Kyle, that it was not handled well.
Oh, okay. All right.
Several times I said, you know, they really should have been a little more preparation, and they really should have known what they could have been a lot smoother. And my hope is that he will learn from this and become a lot smoother.
Okay.
We will see.
Okay, fair enough. Let's talk a little about Sally Yates. She began her testimony about an hour after we went off the air on Monday. And I want to look back on it, not just to look back, but to look forward with this. Michael, Georgia Democrats have expressed a lot of interest and excitement around whether or not they can encourage her to run for governor, this back when she was first fired as acting AG by Trump, and her testimony was viewed, I think, I mean, there are some conservative organizations that certainly were attacking her the way she testified, but I think for the most part, she got pretty good reviews for the way she handled herself, yeah?
She's a brilliant prosecutor. She is revered by folks on both sides of the aisle. I don't think that anyone can seriously say that like Trump alleges, that she is a partisan public servant in the way that she executes her job whatsoever. She's very good at what she does. She's one of the smartest people in the room wherever she goes.
So let's listen back to one of the most remarked upon and most replayed moments in the hearing the other day. It was when Senator Ted Cruz began to question her seemed to believe that he had ammunition that could really do her damage, and here's how it unfolded.
Are you familiar with 8 U.S.C. Section 1182?
Not off the top of my head, no.
By the express text of the statute, it says, quote, whenever the president finds that the entry of any alien or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem appropriate. Would you agree that that is broad statutory authorization?
I would, and I am familiar with that, and I'm also familiar with an additional provision of the INA that says no person shall receive preference or be discriminated against in issuance of a visa because of race, nationality, or place of birth. That, I believe, was promulgated after the statute that you just quoted. And that's been part of the discussion with the courts with respect to the INA, is whether this more specific statute trumps the first one that you just described. Concern was not an INA concern here. It rather was a constitutional concern, whether or not this the executive order here violated the Constitution, specifically with the Establishment Clause and equal protection and due process.
Patricia, when she talks about INA, she's talking about the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And that's what they were quoting from. Boy, she just really hit a home run, it seems to me. And it was almost as if, whether it was going to come from Ted Cruz or probably another less, you know, somebody who didn't want her to succeed, it seems like she was ready for that one.
Well, it really is the fundamental question at the heart of the controversy. Does the president have the authority to block this class of immigrants based on the criteria that he set out at the time and before during the campaign? Was it about a person's religion, or was it about the safety of the United States? Can those coexist at the same time? I did feel like Ted Cruz sort of practice that question in the mirror the night before, and she was like, yeah, I know you're gonna ask that, and and she was very frank. She said, well, this is the heart of the question, and so, but I do think she was obviously prepared for it, and she defended her decision in many different forums, and this was, I think, another one where you can disagree with her, but she certainly had her reasons for doing what she did.
Kyle, you can understand why Georgia Democrats would just love to get her as a candidate for governor, but
except for Stacey Abrams, perhaps.
Well, of course, and maybe Stacey Abrams.
I'm not saying Representative Abrams would be scared of her. I'm just saying she's already in the race. She probably doesn't want a whole lot of others in there. Look, she would be a formidable candidate for sure. She would be. I mean, you think John Ossoff has raised a lot of national money. I think Sally Yates, because of this episode, would also be able to raise a lot of national money for that race. She clearly is very articulate. She is able to handle what comes at her. I think Republicans would prefer not to go up against her, which I would say a lot of the same things about Stacey Abrams, so I don't mean that as a slide against her. But
she's the one in the spotlight. Michael, I know that the party cannot take sides in a primary, but is it fair to say there are Georgia Democrats out there who are trying to recruit her?
There's no active recruitment for Sally Yates, and honestly, I don't even think she has any interest in running for office. I would not be surprised if she served on a nonprofit after all of this, whenever she's done testifying for I don't know how many hearings will be held. But when she does have the time, I would imagine that she won't be running for office.
Yeah, Jackie, those of us who've known her for a really long time, find her we just sort of sense that she's not temperamentally disposed to want to be a candidate. She's very circumspect. She's very self-contained. Mm-hmm. She's very focused. It would be interesting if she decided to make a public run. When her husband ran for the 4th District congressional seat, it was a very nasty campaign against Cynthia McKinney. She saw the worst of what politics can be.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think she's very highly respected, very smart, very articulate. Ted Cruz should have really thought about the response he would have gotten. I mean, you can you listen to that and you think, you really should have known better. You know, that's what's going to happen. Very smart. I think she would be a great candidate for the Democrats. I don't think it takes a lot to run for office, and it takes a lot of being able to put a lot of personal attacks that aren't true necessarily and to just weather them. And I'm not sure at this point in her life that's what she wants to do. Her husband, Comer Yates, runs the Atlanta Speech School. He does a fantastic job. Yeah. They are transforming children's lives, not only across the state, but across the nation, and do an incredible job. So I think she'd have to weigh that very heavily in terms of, you know, what she can contribute and what she wants to do. But she's obviously very well respected. I'm sure that they would love to have her jump in the race.
We are out of time. But a quick note, by the way, speaking of women who may be running for governor on the Democratic side, another woman took herself out of the race either today or late yesterday. I'm not sure which. The mayor of Columbus, Teresa Tomlinson, who was actively weighing whether she wanted to get into this race. She's very well thought of down in Columbus in South Georgia. And she declared she is going to stay where she is for now. And she is going to look actively at a race in 2020, possibly for U.S. Senate against David Perdue. So there's one less candidate that Democrats will have to contend with. That's it. We're out of time. Patricia Murphy, Michael Smith, Jackie Cushman, Kyle Wingfield, thank you all so much for being here. Thanks to our team in the control room, to engineer Tyler Morris, to producer Lisa Clark, to senior producer Jenny Ament. Thanks for all you did to help this show come together today. I'm Bill Nigut. Remember, you can always subscribe to our podcast so you can listen to us whenever you want to. Or you can go to the AJC Political Insider blog at AJC.com, and the audio of the show will be posted there sometime in the next few hours. So you have a couple of ways to catch up with us. We'll see you again Friday at 3 with Jim Galloway, Mark Roundtree, and a cast of thousands. Take care.